It is Wednesday, August 15th, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today, and thanks for listening to RBN. For people who can tell the difference between the truth and disinformation and persuasive, often passionate, indoctrination. To see the guest lineup for Studios A and B, please click on the word schedule in the RBN banner at the top of the page at republicbroadcasting.org. Please visit the radio schedule page for this program at spingola.com to see a list of my guests together with links to their websites. For questions or comments during the program, please email spingola1 at yahoo.com. Otherwise, my regular email is deanna at spingola.com. We will take your calls in the second hour after the first break at 800-313-9443. The first proposal to impose an income tax on citizens occurred during the War of 1812. After 2 years of war, the federal government had accumulated $100 million in debt. In his book, Peter Hendrickson states that the Lincoln administration initiated the income tax through the Revenue Act of 1862, dated July 1, 1862, which included a tax on personal incomes to help pay war expenses. Congress then created the Office of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. In 1866, federal internal revenue collections reached their highest point in the nation's 90-year history, more than $310 million. Many people think that Congress repealed this act in 1872, but that is not the case. There is a lot that we do not know about the taxes we volunteer to pay. Our guest today is going to enlighten us. He is Peter Hendrickson. His website is losthorizons.com. He is the author of Cracking the Code, The Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Thank you very much, Deanna. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Your book is fascinating. I have not read it completely, but intend to, of course. It needs to be studied. Rather, it's not a quick read.
No, it's not. No, but I can tell that you've already dipped into it, and I appreciate that.
Enlighten us about this whole taxation thing. Probably the best place to start would be an explanation of the indirect or direct taxation and how it applies to us.
Sure, that's an excellent starting point. When the Constitution, the current version of the Constitution was crafted in 1787 and adopted in 1789, it provided a new authority to the federal government, that is one of collecting taxes, and in so doing, and in reflective of the reluctance with which the founders and framers expanded any power they were granting to the federal government, the tax authority was granted under a couple of very restrictive rules. As any student of American history knows, taxation was always a very key concern of the founding generation. In fact, to a large degree, the revolution against the overlordship of Britain was fought because of what were deemed to be oppressive taxation rates and practices, with that rate actually never exceeding anything, even actually never even approaching so much as 3% or so of the earnings and wealth of any of the colonists, but it was intolerable nonetheless. So they took taxation very seriously. And in
Peter, we do need to take a quick break. We will be back in 3 minutes, and you can pick it up on the other
side.
Very
good.
Chlorine, fluoride, pathogens, and more are in the water you drink day to day. Do you want the ability to remove and reduce those harmful things in the water you drink? You can. How? With a Berkey water filter. A complete standalone gravity filter system that requires no electricity and no plumbing. Use for emergencies or for every day. Berkey systems come in 7 different sizes. Where can you get one? from GetBerkey.com. That's GetBerkey.com. With the purchase of each system, you get 50% off accessories, such as fluoride filters, water level spigot, and sport bottles. Plus, free shipping on all orders over $25. For a limited time, get 5% off all ceramic systems when you use coupon code RBN. Call GetBerkey at 855-GetBerkey. That's 855-438-2375. Or visit GetBerkey.com. That's GetBerkey.com.
Purified water?
Check.
MREs?
14 cases? Check.
Seed bank? Seed bank?
No seed bank.
What do you mean, no seed bank?
Honey, it's just so confusing. I don't know which one to buy.
I met the Texas Ready Seed Lady at a gun show last weekend. Her Liberty Seed Banks blow everything else away.
Why do you say that?
Well, check out this brochure, which I kind of forgot to give you.
Oops.
Yeah, sorry. Look, here. They have over 75 varieties, which means that if something doesn't grow well this year, there's plenty of other stuff to fall back on.
Oh, hey! They have instruction manuals, too.
Exactly. Buy one.
Check.
Flashlights?
Check.
Batteries?
Check.
Box of dum-dum shells?
Check, check.
Yes, friends, you may order your Texas Ready Heirloom Seed Bank at texasready.net. That's texasready.net. Are you Texas ready?
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed a newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! Huh. For some reason, the majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper doesn't give out the important attention of what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Peter Hendrickson. His website is losthorizons.com. Okay, Peter, go ahead and continue from where we left off.
Yeah, we were talking about the taxation mechanisms that were allowed by the founders and framers in revising the Constitution in 1787. That was a revision of the original Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, in which no taxing power was granted to the federal government at all. But in 1787, having been convinced that the government needed some ability to gather its own revenue rather than being entirely dependent on grants from the state governments, which had been the previous mechanism, the authority was given to the federal government to capture revenue from certain things and in certain ways. It was granted the authority to charge fees for the use of its own stuff, and it was granted a bunch of stuff. It was granted effective ownership of a kind of invisibly thin line around the perimeter of the aggregated state territories. It was granted property of its own, and a number of other resources, along with delegated powers, the exercise of which, the profitable exercise of which, it was then given permission to charge for. And it was also given the mechanism by which it could impose what were called direct taxes, but only via the mechanism of apportionment, which meant that the direct taxes would be totaled up as to a figure and a nominal object of the tax. That total would then be divided into outstanding liabilities on the part of the state governments, each of which was proportioned to the national or to the population of that state as a proportion of the total national population. So, even under the direct tax structure, direct taxes did not mean that the federal government was empowered to directly tax citizens. it was empowered to produce an invoice for each of the state governments proportioned to their ratio of the national population. And the state governments are the ones liable for paying the tax. How they collected the money internally was their own problem and their own matter, and it's the subject of their own constitutional limitations. So that's a direct tax, and all direct taxes remain subject to that rule. Indirect taxes, on the other hand, are taxes that arise on the occasion of an event. They're voluntary in their essential character in this respect. Engaging in the activity that prompts the tax is a voluntary choice. Now, once that activity has been engaged in, paying the tax is involuntary. It's just a contract. When you've decided voluntarily to do something that brings an obligation on you, satisfying the obligation is no longer a voluntary matter. That becomes mandatory. So that's the structure that we have in the federal system. The federal government was authorized to, by the mechanism of the legislature, of course, which were representatives of the people in the states and the states themselves under the original structure. Senators were appointed by state governments. So they would decide to impose a direct tax upon themselves, upon their state governments. And indirect taxes were permitted via, a piece of the action, claim on voluntary choices, and with the rules only being that they be uniform in their structure, which is to say that the fee placed on buying a thing in Delaware would have to be the same fee placed on buying the same thing in Ohio. So that was the structure. And that remains the structure that we have in this country today. Nothing has changed.
Okay. And, of course, the 16th and 17th Amendment changed a few things that...
In a manner of speaking. The 16th is broadly misunderstood. The 17th is probably not misunderstood, but is off the radar screen of most people, and it's an unfortunate thing. It was a very important amendment. It had a big impact on the political dynamic in this country. It essentially made... senators no longer appointees of state governments, but providers for them to be elected by the state population as a whole. That changed the loyalties and interests of members of the Senate from being, much more responsive to the states as independent units, and much more national political hacks, if you'll pardon the expression. And that did have a big impact on the way politics plays out in this country. Didn't have an impact on the taxing power in any meaningful way, though, other than, again, changing the political dynamic somewhat so that the interests of those senators in disciplining the federal government and its exercise of the taxing power that it does have is different than it once had been. But that power was not expanded by that 17th Amendment, nor was it expanded by the 16th Amendment, the one that's very broadly understood. And in fact, that misunderstanding is nurtured and cultivated by tax agencies and beneficiaries of misunderstanding of the income tax, because it is only by misunderstanding the 16th Amendment that the prospect that there is somehow a general, more or less direct inaction tax on money or earnings or economic activity in general in this country today, which there absolutely is not. But again, by misunderstanding the 16th Amendment and its effects, it's easy to misunderstand the nature of the tax.
And don't you think that was rather deliberate? And didn't Bill Benson has made a case that he states that the states never did actually ratify that amendment?
Yeah, I think that case is well made. I've read Bill Benson's work. He did an amazing job of accumulating data, and I think, as I said, he makes a very convincing case that the ratification did not take place as it was supposed to have in a sufficient number of states to actually formally meet the constitutional requirements for ratifying that amendment. It was declared ratified nonetheless by Philander Knox, the Secretary of State at the time, and has been deemed to have been ratified by the Supreme Court when the occasion, when the issue has come before it, sort of as a fait accompli, if nothing else. And that's a bad thing, because we don't like to tolerate any kind of sloppiness or latitude in the exercise of the law. We need the law to be very scrupulously adhered to in every possible respect for our own sakes. But nonetheless, the 16th Amendment didn't do anything really dramatic, and so the concern about its ratification, I think, is misdirected. We shouldn't care so much about the 16th because it really didn't do anything. All it did was close a loophole that had been opened in the application of the tax to a small category of what qualifies as subject to the income tax that was opened by the Supreme Court in Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust in 1895. And that loophole insulated the gains of essentially the railroad magnates that had benefited from enormous federal subsidies and grants in the creation of the National Railroads, in which there was a ferocious amount of political corruption, lots and lots of members of the legislature that were involved in making these grants and subsidies to these robber baron railroaders were given stock in organizations and benefited enormously themselves. And by the time of the Grover Cleveland administration, the American people had gotten pretty upset at this, and they sought to impose to add to the existing income tax structure a tax on the dividends and rental gains that these robber baron railroad magnates were enjoying. And the Supreme Court in Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust, suit brought by one of these people who was trying to thwart the application of the tax to dividends he was about to be paid, decided that to tax dividends amounted to a tax on the stock from which they came, from which they were derived. The stock is personal property, therefore the tax amounted to a property tax. And so the court called it a direct tax and said it had to be apportioned. A few years later, under the Taft administration's exhortations, the 16th Amendment was written and proposed and eventually declared adopted. And the 16th Amendment just says that someone in that position, someone enjoying the benefit of a federally connected gain, couldn't resort to the source in order to insulate that gain from the tax. And that's all that it did. It did not expand the tax to different new objects, things that it hadn't been applicable to before the 16th Amendment. It just said what the Pollock Court ruled no longer will protect these particular federally connected gains from the tax. That's all. This has been said by the Supreme Court repeatedly since the 16th Amendment. It's been said by the Treasury Department drafts people repeatedly since then. It's been said by every authority since then. It is the fact. It's what the 16th was all about. But not understanding that causes people to think that the 16th Amendment created a new kind of hybrid tax that is direct somehow in its application, and yet it's also a capitation, which is to say a tax on revenue that is undistinguished by the exercise of privilege, that being what capitation is in the constitutional sense. All of this being very technical, very complicated, I know, to hear, it's impossible to summarize in a 10-minute nutshell, I'm sorry to say. That's kind of why I had to write the book, Cracking the Code, Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America, and I urge everyone listening that is scratching their head right now at some of these terms and some of these concepts to take the time to read the book in order to clarify these things.
Absolutely. I second your recommendation. All righty, we do have to take a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Hey, meat eaters, the freeze-dry guy wants to know, does your emergency food supply meet the standards for survival? Then get the 144-day meat variety unit from the freeze-dry guy. Our meat units utilize only quality Mountain House freeze-dried cooked ground chicken and ground beef, the undisputed choice for great taste and highest nutrition. The Freeze Dry Guy's 144-day meat variety unit includes six number 10 cans of the very best freeze-dried animal protein for power you'll need when the going gets tough. Every Meat Eater's 144-day meat variety unit comes with a free medical kit and always free shipping to the lower 48. Need more than 144 days? See our one-year-plus Meat Eater's units at freezedryguy.com. And hey, the Freeze Dry Guy still has LRP rations, but they're going fast. Don't wait until tomorrow. Call now, 866-404-3663. That's 866-404-3663. Or go to freezedryguy.com and meet the standards for survival.
In 2010, millions of people were awakened to the question of what. Now the next question that remains to be answered is, why in the world are they spraying? An investigative look into one of the many agendas associated with chemtrail geoengineering programs, weather control. Why in the world are they spraying? Premiering and streaming live August 18th at the three-day event, Consciousness Beyond Chemtrails Conference and Fundraiser in Los Angeles. For more info, go to www.cbclive2012.com. Why in the world are they spraying? Order your copy today at www.whyintheworldaretheyspraying.com. Watch the premiere live August 18th at the three-day event, Consciousness Beyond Chemtrails Conference and Fundraiser in Los Angeles. For more info, go to www.cbclive2012.com. Why in the world are they spraying?
And if you control the weather, you're going to control the planet. It's that simple.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
A healthy heart starts with Extendovite. I've always believed that I had to have a strong defense to overcome the new superbugs of today. Extendovite, a 7-herb heart protection cocktail, not only helped me to overcome a massive heart attack, but it also has built up my natural immune defenses against colds and flus. Extendovite has so many benefits that we all should be taking Extendovite to build up our defenses for what superbugs might emerge yet. So start today, clean out the toxins, and be as healthy as you can be. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822. Or visit our website at heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Today is Peter Hendrickson. His website is losthorizons.com. Now, many of us have heard of former IRS agent Joseph Bannister and former IRS agent Sherry Jackson, who they convicted of willful failure to file. She spent a few years in jail and just got off probation on August 8th. As opposed to the 800 people on your website who have legally and successfully got their money back.
Yeah, all their money back, including Social Security and Medicare contributions, by the way. I'm glad you went there, Deanna. That's kind of where I wanted to go after that sort of mind-boggling summary just before the break. Because while the history of the tax is not enormously complicated, but it has a lot of facets. And the tax itself, the tax code as written, 7.5 million words, is extraordinarily complex. The practical reality of the subject we're talking about today, the income tax, is that it is a tax that doesn't apply to most people. It doesn't apply to the earnings of most people, I should say. It isn't a person-related application. It's a activity-related application. So anybody in the whole world is theoretically capable of engaging in activities that could cause the tax liability to arise, but most people don't. And the 800 that you mentioned that whose complete refund checks and levy releases, and lien releases, and garnishment reimbursements and notice of deficiency closing notices and so forth that I have posted at LostHorizons.com are a sampling of the tens of thousands of readers of Cracking the Code that have learned what the tax actually applies to, that have acted on that knowledge, and have gotten all of their withheld or paid-in money back year after year in many cases. And that, again, is because the tax doesn't actually apply to the earnings of most folks. It is a federal income tax. The nature of the tax is in its name. No one recognizes this because they tend to think of it, they parse the sentence in the wrong way. They think of it as a federal tax on income. That really is not the proper meaning of the phrase. The proper meaning is it is a tax on federal income. It is a federal income tax. And that's all it is. It's a tax on the gains from making use of federal stuff. It's an excise tax, and an excise means a piece of the action. And who gets to claim a piece of the action? Somebody whose stuff has been used to generate the action. Just that simple. It's just like any other arrangement. It's like if you set up a lemonade stand, or if you, your neighbor, set up a lemonade stand at the end of your driveway, you would be entitled to charge a percentage of his gains for the use of your property. Perfectly natural. This is exactly the same kind of arrangement. That's what the federal income tax is. And having learned that, people then look at their earnings and make educated, rational decisions about whether their earnings qualify under that standard or don't. And if they don't, they say so in a legally meaningful manner and claim the return of any property that has been withheld or paid in against a possible liability for the tax for any given period, and they get it back. And that's that. So really, all the complicated stuff can, in a way, you know, be left on the back burner. The most important thing are the practical realities, and that's basically what those practical realities are.
Okay. You've given some examples in your book. You talk about, on page 26, 27, you talk about the two individuals who traded, one gave a sheep and then the other one traded for some labor, I believe. Let me just go to your
book. Yeah, a discussion of the nature of gain, essentially, what really amounts to a gain, and whether, you know, merely exchanging paper tokens or even real money, such as gold or silver, constitutes a gain, or does it constitute a net balance? It's an important distinction. The courts recognize the gain feature as an element of the application of the tax. It isn't the sole element, but it is an element, and so I do discuss it some.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit further about that. Basically, what you're saying there on page 26 is that no one received any income in the example of the carpenter who exchanged labor basically for a sheep. And he says, and you say, no one received any income in our example because by merely trading what they already possessed for its equivalent value in someone else's property, none of our citizens increased their wealth. They simply converted pre-existing assets to a different form, which I think is really significant.
Well, it is significant, although, again, I don't want that to complicate the understanding of the tax. It is significant. And it's important that everyone understand what an exchange in an economy really is. It's very
right.
important.
Right.
Although at the same time, gain is only one of the features that is a necessary component of qualifying an earning or a receipt for the application of the tax. And we can get into that a little bit more detail after the break here.
All righty. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Do you flinch when a police car appears in your rearview mirror or you get pulled over? Are you squeamish when an envelope arrives in the mail with a return address of a court, a government agency like the IRS, or some law firm? Would you like to escape government agency harassment? Then visit escapeharassment.com. George Bush allegedly says, the government constitution is nothing but a doggone piece of paper. Well, that's a contract. A contract is an offer acceptance of that offer, at which point a contract arises by law and the offerer can no longer withdraw the offer. We teach, do not accept. That way there is no contract or agreement for you to go to their court or private club meeting. To escape government agency harassment like the IRS, visit escapeharassment.com. This is a tried and proven experienced process, not experimental, with a money-back guarantee that it works and success testimonials from previous students. Remember, escapeharassment.com. That's escapeharassment.com.
Meet Jerry D.
Hi.
Jerry and his family, like you, are very concerned about world conditions and have gathered many emergency preparedness items, including turtle tough shelters.
We have added 2 24-foot turtle toughs to our supplies and feel very secure knowing our large family is ready for whatever the future may bring.
Turtle tough shelters are not tents. They are permanent yet portable four-season geodesic frame shelters that are as strong as a cabin at a fraction of the cost, and are easy to set up, take down, and move anywhere. Available in 2 sizes. Get your Turtle Tough shelter and accessories included at TurtleToughShelters.com. That's Turtle, T-U-F-F, Shelters.com. Or call 801-623-3288. That's 801-623-3288. Or see them online at TurtleToughShelters.com. Turtle Tough Shelters, your all-season home away from home.
In times like these, you can't depend on the government to keep you warm and fed, but you can depend on the Vermont Bun Baker to do just that. With a Vermont Bun Baker, you'll never be in a situation where you can't cook, bake, fry, boil water, or heat your home all at the same time. One of the most revolutionary cook stoves, wood stoves ever, the Vermont Bun Baker is available with or without soapstone veneer, a natural stone that retains heat and radiates it back into the room once the fire is out. A beautiful addition to your home, the Vermont Bun Baker has an efficiency rating well above 75% and qualifies for the wood stove tax credit. For more information, watch the Vermont Bun Baker on YouTube and live stream, or visit us at www.vermontwoodstove.com. You can also reach us by calling 1-866-SOAPSTONE. Don't ever be hungry or cold because the power's gone out. With a Vermont Bun Baker, all you have to worry about is what's for dinner.
Okay, what our listeners really would like to know probably is the jurisdictional aspects of who exactly is subject to the income tax, and they would also like to know how to avoid surrendering the product of their labor to the government and how to get back what they've already volunteered to pay.
Sure. Those definitely are the kind of where the rubber hits the road. And and we covered the first thing a bit, the jurisdictional aspects. Again, when somebody uses somebody else's stuff, that somebody else gains jurisdiction. They have the authority to speak, to say what is going to happen, what the law is going to be concerning the use of their stuff. Nobody has to use their stuff. They choose to, and when they choose to, they adopt the strings that come with the deal. And that is what federal jurisdiction, as far as the excise tax and income tax, is all about. It's them saying what the deal is going to be, and the deal that they say is if you use their stuff, you pay them 15% or 28% or 33% or whatever of the what they will qualify as a gain, minus deductions that they allow, and so on and so forth. At that point, you're in the 7.5 million word tax code, and you know, life is complicated, and you need tax attorneys and CPAs and so on and so forth. But of course, if you don't put your lemonade stand at the end of their driveway, You don't have to deal with any of those things. If you put it at the end of your own driveway, you're the one exercising jurisdiction.
And okay, but is their driveway the 10-mile square District of Columbia?
No, it's not. It's not a territorial thing. It's their driveway is their stuff. Their driveway is if you, for instance, are administering a federal land bank where you're leasing. You know, you're in the business of administering the leasing of federal lands to timber producers or timber harvesters, for instance. That's using their stuff. Doing anything else that uses their powers. If you're a bureaucrat in a federal agency, you're exercising federal power. Actually, you're using federal stuff, and you're getting paid for doing it, and this is part of the deal. If you invest in the Tennessee Valley Authority or any other federal corporation, you're using their stuff by proxy, and you adopt the rules of the deal. All those cases adopt the rules of the deal. It's not territorial. You don't have to live in Washington, D.C. in order to be liable for a tax for gains you get from buying stock in the Tennessee Valley Authority. You could be living in Italy and be liable for that tax. It's because you've used their stuff. It's not because of where you are. It's not because of who you are. It's because of what you did.
Okay, but if you just work for a living, or if you're a small businessman, or you, just gain.
Just a person using your own resources. Yeah. Then of course not. Of course they have no claim to a piece of the action, a piece of your action. They have nothing to do with it, and that's also how it works. And the key is understanding the difference between those two things, which is not complicated. You know, it has a few subtleties of a sort, but they're not complicated. And then knowing how to express that fact, the fact of whose stuff you were using, in an environment in which there is a long entrenched institutional process or protocol for everybody who pays anyone in this country in particular to create legal instruments that imply that you were using federal stuff when you made the money that person paid you. And that's the part where it gets a little more complicated, not dramatically so. It's actually very, very simple, but a little more complicated because it isn't enough for the reality to be that you weren't using federal stuff. You are unfortunately and kind of obnoxiously obliged to say that you weren't and to do so in a legally meaningful manner. Now, happily, the method for doing that, the mechanism for doing that has been provided by Congress, as it would have had to have been. And even if Congress had not, it's a very standard, straightforward matter of legal practices to rebut allegations of the use of federal stuff, just as it would be to rebut the allegations of the use of your neighbor's stuff, were they to be made. In this case, typically when someone is paid something, in this country, what is called an information return of some variety is produced. W-2s are information returns, 1099s are information returns, K-1s are information returns. It's a special kind of form produced by the Treasury Department, and it's a form that's to be used to report transactions involving federal stuff. Sadly, it has become the norm for everybody to report every transaction on one of these forms, leaving it to the person about whom the report is made to sort out the truth of the matter. And it's unfortunate that this be the case. It is kind of understandable when you really get a grasp of what is going on. It's understandable why everyone does this by default. It simplifies things for them. And because there is a mechanism for a person to correct incorrect allegations, it's legally forgivable as well. And so, yes, you have to know how these allegations are made and how one goes about correcting them and how one puts those corrections into the record. And, you know, that's something that is covered in detail in cracking the code. It's something that all of those tens of thousands of readers who have been recovering all of their money all these years know how to do and have exercised. And so, yeah, that's part of the picture.
And those 800 people that you have listed on your website have not gone to jail.
No, absolutely not. I have now. but no one else.
And what did they?
I was charged with not believing anything that we've been talking about today, Deanna. And you can tell that I'm just making this up on the fly as we go, I'm sure.
Right. Well, you know, it's really unfortunate that the employers in this country all obligate their employees to fill these things out, and they are kind of working apparently complicitly with the government.
Well, it is unfortunate, but you know, the reason that it happens, revealed itself in the words you used to describe the situation. You said every employer does these things about every employee, and that is a part of the trick that's involved in the misapplication of the income tax, because terms like employer and employee are actually custom defined terms in tax law. They don't mean what you just used them to mean. You were referring to companies and workers without distinction. Employer and employee in the tax code doesn't refer to companies and workers. It refers to federal entities and the people who work for those federal entities. And the definitions provided in the law make that perfectly clear. So when someone in tax law context speaks of an employer or an employee, they're only talking about those companies and those workers. They're not talking about all companies and all workers. But these definitions and these distinctions are not made clear in anything that the IRS ever sends to a company, nor are they made clear to the CPAs that the IRS trains in tax law. And so everyone over the course of a couple of generations since the time that some of these definitions have been in place has come to confuse the terms or not recognize that there's anything being confused or to be confused. And they tend to think of employee when they get something from the IRS as meaning their workers automatically, rather than recognizing the necessity of saying, well, is this thing talking about my people or is it not talking about my people? And that's, again, a very key element of how the tax has come to be broadly misapplied, and it's the reason why up to about the late 1930s, 1939 or so, never did more than 8% of the American population, the working percent of the population, file a tax return of any kind. But by 1943, after some of these quirky definitions had gone into place, the rate was in the 90% neighborhood, and has stayed there ever since. Of course, there wasn't any constitutional amendment that happened in the 1940s. Nothing changed. What changed was the craft with which the tax was designed and the manner in which it came to be misunderstood.
And during some interesting years, during the Depression and
sure.
the FDR administration?
A lot of things had happened, yeah. A couple generations had gone by from, for instance, the passage of the 16th Amendment and the reasons for that amendment and its meaning had become largely lost to general knowledge. The Depression had occurred. We were in the middle of a war. Walt Disney was producing Donald Duck cartoons, urging people to just pay whatever the government asked them to pay and not ask questions. And things went the way they did. And now we're at a point of having recognized that even leaving aside the issue of the significance of enforcing the Constitution, seeing to it that it is scrupulously abided by our servant governments, the general state of understanding of law overall has become very, very fragile in this country. And so it really behooves all of us to really drill down on this and to get busy with our civic responsibilities in these areas.
And how would one go about getting their money back and not filing? What are the steps?
You can't. The not filing thing is not really an option. You know, you made reference to Joe Bannister and Sherry Jackson earlier.
Right.
A couple of wonderful folks. But folks who themselves didn't have a clear grasp of a key aspect of the tax, which is that, well, two key aspects. And for one thing, both those people did actually work for the government. And,
right. They were both liable for the tax, right?
Yeah, they were liable for the tax. That was one part of it. The other part was a misunderstanding about how it is that that one has to correct erroneous information about one's earnings. And that is by, kind of weirdly, it's by filing a tax return. Tax returns are not mechanisms designed to provide for people to send their money into the government. Tax returns are affidavits. They're testimonial documents by which a person says what is or isn't true about their earnings in the previous year, typically in response to other allegations about that those same events in that same time frame. So that's I talked a little bit about the necessity of rebutting bad information. This is the mechanism by which it's done. This is the mechanism that the government recognizes and specifies as the way to tell it what was true. The information return preparer, I mentioned information returns, W-2s, 1099s, and so forth in the past, mm-hmm. they send a document to the government saying what I paid Joe Smith was because of the use of your property. And the government takes this and says, oh, well, then Joe must owe us a tax. But let's see what Joe says. Joe then produces his own document and says either, yes, it's true, what the information return preparer said is true, I did use your stuff, and so, you know, I'm going to calculate a tax and all that, or you guys can do it for me, you know, whatever. Or Joe says, well, no, actually, that wasn't true. So-and-so is mistaken, and what I did didn't involve any of your stuff at all. Please send all my money back. That's it. And that testimony is done by way of a 1040, among other things.
And so, that is what you did.
Absolutely.
And how did they respond initially?
Oh, I got all my money back.
You by return mail, they sent you a check?
In my case, they actually credited it to what they alleged to have been an outstanding balance for a previous year. Second year, they sent the check. And that's what has been the case with all of the tens of thousands of people that have been doing this, having learned the truth about the tax these many years.
So I have to ask, why did they incarcerate you?
Well, I was accused of not believing that my earnings didn't qualify as subject to the tax when I said that that's the case on my tax forms. The trial was a show trial. The jury was not allowed to actually see the law that defines the things that I was testifying about on my tax form, for instance, wages. Even though the jury asked to see that, recognizing the significance of the statutory language involved, the court would not let the jury see it. I wasn't allowed to put any IRS experts on the stand. No one testified that that what I said wasn't true. The court simply gave the jury prosecution written definitions of terms involved, and that was that.
And the jury was not knowledgeable enough to recognize what was going on.
No, unfortunately, they were not. This was by no means a fully informed jury. seemed to be good folks to me for the most part. Although it was really astonishing how difficult it was to end up with a jury that didn't include a lot of government workers. Really surprising how readily those folks show up for jury duty as compared to the population as a whole. But I have no necessarily inherent complaints about the people on the jury. It was they operated perhaps unfortunately with a little too much acceptance of whatever was said by the government attorneys and the court, rather than doing any thinking for themselves, for the most part, except insofar as their request to see the law themselves. That was evidence of somebody that had their brain turned on that day, but of course that was denied, and so ultimately they did as the court instructed them to do, and that made it a foregone conclusion.
Wow. And, of course, we have this this prevalent mentality that everyone must pay their fair share. And, of course, as you mentioned earlier, This was drummed into our heads by Hollywood and by the media, that we all have to pay our fair share in order for our government to work and in order to pay for all of the wonderful things that our government does for us, right?
Yeah, absolutely true. Although I want to point out that, you know, the truth about the tax, about the income tax, has no real impact on federal revenue in any direct sense. The federal government could easily and properly accumulate, you know, $4.3 trillion a year to shoot people in other countries and build bridges to nowhere in Alaska and pave what remains of the of West Virginia, if the American people really wanted that to happen by the fully constitutional mechanism.
All righty, we'll be right back after a break and a word from our sponsors.
Don't answer it! How can I stop these annoying collection calls?
Imagine being free from your debt without settling and with no payment plan, no negotiating or filing bankruptcy, and no attorneys. What if you could eliminate the risk from all your unsecured debt in about 90 days and keep all your money? You can. It's called Zero Debt Guarantee, and it works. There's no other program of its kind on the planet, and we guarantee the results in writing. Call now, 800-477-9256. Let our team of experts provide you with the resources to fight back, stop collection calls, and prevent and stop wage garnishments and bank levies. If you're facing foreclosure, we can help. Don't go it alone. Get free information now by calling 800-477-9256. Talk to an expert who has also completed our program. Call 800-477-9256 for free info or go to ZeroDebtGuarantee.com. That's 800-477-9256 or go to ZeroDebtGuarantee.com.
In an emergency situation, would you drink contaminated water? You could if you had the amazing Life Straw from MyPatriotSupply.com. Life Straw is the most advanced personal water filter available today. It filters contaminated water from almost any source. Life Straw is lightweight and compact, perfect for hiking, camping, or in an emergency like a flood. Life Straw is easy to clean, comes with a 1-year warranty, and has been used worldwide since 2005. Get the amazing Life Straw personal water filter at MyPatriotSupply.com. Plus, check out Survival Seed Vault, 20 seed varieties for only $37.95, Tattler canning lids, long-term storable foods as low as $69.95, and much more at MyPatriotSupply.com. Enjoy stress-free shipping on all orders over $49. Call 866-229-0927 or visit MyPatriotSupply.com. That's 866-229-0927, MyPatriotSupply.com, for emergency preparedness, self-reliance, and food independence.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Welcome back. I am Deanna, and our guest today is Peter Hendrickson. His website is losthorizons.com. He is the author of Cracking the Code, The Fascinating Truth About Taxation in America. We will take calls in the next hour after the first break at 800-313-9443. And Peter, just before the break, you said that basically the federal government can rake in enough money to take care of all of its activities.
Absolutely. You know, the founders set up the structure that they did intending for there to be close political accountability. They meant for the government to be restrained, but they meant for it to be restrained only insofar as and to the extent that the American citizenry wanted it to be. If the American citizens want the federal government to have all the money money that it has right now, all the money that it spends right now, and that's without regard to the degree to which it spends beyond its means, you know, deficit spending. The federal government is perfectly empowered to impose a direct tax, claiming that amount, and you know, obviously Congress would have to agree to it. Congress would be the one doing it, imposing the tax. And it would be collected from the states under the apportionment mechanism, and there would be the money. This is not a problem. The problem is for the political class, because getting the money that way has a lot of political accountability. What the money is going to get spent on has to be identified. It's a one-time deal. It has to be renewed each time that that amount is sought. It's not like the current misadministered income tax, which operates more like an open spigot of money flowing into the federal treasury. Congress could do nothing for the next 30 years, and it would still take in what it's taking in now under the misadministered income tax, because it doesn't involve any congressional activity. There's no voting that goes on. Nothing has to be done. It's just you have to figure out where you're going to spend the money. The founders didn't intend for it to be that way. They meant for Congress to have to ask for its resources, to account for its resources and account for its activities. And the mechanisms they set up provide for that. So it isn't that the proper administration of the income tax would itself reduce federal revenue. It's that federal restraint, or the restraint on the federal government and its spending, would probably proceed as a consequence of the tax being properly administered, which would not, by the way, eliminate income tax revenues. It would simply shrink them a bit. There are probably 30 million people in this country that do receive more than the exemption amount of income. What qualifies as income, I'll say income with quote marks around it, what qualifies as income subject to the tax. It's not an inconsiderable number. It's a lot of people. But, of course, it also leaves 270 or 280 million people whose earnings don't qualify. And that's also a very, very large number indeed. And
right.
So there would still be income tax revenue, and there would be other revenue sources, the tariff, other excise tax that the federal government imposes, and the government would have the resort to an apportioned direct tax any time it needed it, just as was used for the first 140 years or so of our country's history. The federal government relied entirely on about a dozen direct tax impositions and a revenue tariff to fund all of its activities for that 140 years.
Right.
Certainly can be done.
All righty. We need to take our 60-second top of the hour break, and we'll be right back after Station ID.
Are you a